Welcome to the Lost Horror Podcast. This is your weekly show for movies and other things in the entertainment world. Joining me, as usual, is my co-host, Eric Sayor.
Hello.
And for our first thing that, well, I don't know. This is going to be weird for listeners, depending on how things go. But the topic we're going to talk about right now is a fairly recent news story. It's going to be pretty topical for this show. And it's the Oscars and the new category that they are adding to everybody's surprise, including myself.
Like, everybody... Who thought this was a good idea?
I don't know. Here's the thing.
Okay, so if you're not up to date, the Oscars announced recently that they're gonna change their format, how they air on television, and they're gonna add a category for best popular film. Or something like that. I don't...
Yeah, best, most popular film, which I... Okay, so we both sort of talked about this on Twitter a little bit, so anybody who follows both of us probably got a little preview. But, yeah, they're going to give awards out to films that are popular, whatever that means. However they're going to decide that. And... Yeah, like, I just don't... I don't... It kind of goes against what the Oscars is supposed to be in a weird way. Not that it should be impenetrable, and not that it should be so artsy and up its own ass that nobody wants to pay attention to it, but at the same time, it shouldn't necessarily be the movies that everybody's already celebrating. It should be the artists celebrating the artists, and... Yeah,
like popular films make billions of dollars.
Yeah,
and you can just look at the box office list of the movie that made most during that year, and that's your most popular movie. Like, why do they need to award stuff like that? Like, it's weird. It's like they're trying to appeal to.
Yeah.
Who knows, like, people that watch Marvel films that won't really care, still won't care.
I mean, like, so, like, I think it was the 2009 or 2010 Oscars, Avatar was nominated, which is about as much as it needed, because it already won, technically. It already won as much as it needed. You really didn't need to give it an Academy Award, and... Luckily, it went to, I would say, the better film.
Agreed.
But yeah, like those movies, they don't need that recognition. That's what the Pop Choice Awards or whatever are for. That's what the Teen Choice Awards are for. And that's what those things are for.
I specifically mentioned the MTV Movie Awards.
Mm-hmm.
Who's best film of the year usually goes to like something. Really, really popular.
Yeah. Like, I mean, their nominees in the past have included Twilight. You know, I made a joke about, well, I can't wait for whenever they reboot Twilight for whatever's on there to be on this list, because it will be, sadly. Like, I don't... And here's the thing. If they announced that they were saying, we are going to pick these movies... just because we know that they are popular, that they are in the ether, and we think that they are deserving. If there was even, like, any sense of they're actually picking these things, they're not using numbers or whatever, they're sort of going off of word of mouth, so it's sort of an even split, that would be something, but it doesn't seem like they're going to be doing that. It does seem like they're going to go to Box Office Mojo and say, what are the top five on here that have over 70% on Rotten Tomatoes? It would be great if they cited that, though, when they were announcing it.
But I think how the category is going to happen is just that everyone's going to vote for it, like Best Picture.
Yeah.
So it's just going to be what people think is the best movie that also is popular, which I think is kind of like it will bring more, like it's going to be interesting to see like the nominations.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Like it's going to be interesting to see like what people in the film industry actually like that is also a big budget blockbuster.
Yeah, that will be fascinating, I guess. And if they are going off of the Academy members, that will be something. But at the same time, like, I don't know, add a bit more of a crafting of the Best Picture category. Instead of just going off the numbers, if there are three movies that can't qualify, but you know people want to see them in the Best Picture category, just open it up so that you have 10 Best Picture category nominees. And if those other three are Black Panther, so on and so forth, then put them on there. I feel like that's much more reasonable than making an entire category. I don't know.
Yeah, no, it's...
How do you feel about that?
Yeah, it's also... how the news, like, the news came out of where that decision came from, and it kind of was suggested by ABC, I think, which is owned by Disney, of course.
Right.
Yeah. Which is like Disney is saying, please make a category that will give us multiple Oscar nominees and Oscars almost every year.
Yeah, they'll dominate that category. they will dominate it, and it will be basically a free commercial for the DVD releases of those movies. That's what they're asking
for. If we're talking about, like, if that category had happened last year, what would have won? Like, probably... Last Jedi?
Not Last Jedi. If we're going off of the industry, maybe... but I don't think it would have won necessarily. I think it would have been nominated.
Because everyone that liked Last Jedi loved Last Jedi, and like half the people loved Last Jedi. So I think that's enough for it to win against like four other films.
But yeah, and industry folks did know it better. Like they understood what was going on, I guess. They were less the audience that's like, I want Luke to save the day every time, that sort of thing, or whatever.
The audience that picked Shape of Water as the best picture, I think, is going to enjoy Last Jedi more than...
And Dunkirk would still not win anything because people hate Christopher Nolan, I guess.
Dunkirk, so. Maybe in that category. Thor Ragnarok, I guess that's the best superhero movie of last year.
You know what? Honestly, I'm reconsidering my opinion on this category. that's instated posthumously. I don't know what that word applies.
Yeah.
Let's put it in so Ragnarok can be an Oscar-winning film.
The Wonder Woman. Because Wonder Woman. Yeah, Wonder Woman would have won. Actually,
It definitely would have won. Yeah. But hey, wait a second. Maybe this isn't such a bad idea. But no, here's the thing. I would rather, in the year the Wonder Woman came out and the year Thor Ragnarok came out, I would rather that Wonder Woman had been added to the 10 Best Picture category. Because that year it was like, there were only 6 nominations. And last year there was like 7, if I'm remembering correctly. So like, just fill out that category.
8 movies? And everyone was hoping Wonder Woman would be like one of 10. Like, it should have been one of 10. Not because I think... I don't think it's one of the 10 best movies of last year, but I still think it's because of what it is, it has its place in that category.
Yes. Yes, definitely. I think it's good enough, I will say.
More than thing. Fucking...
And also, there aren't movies I would put ahead of it.
More so. Than The Darkest Hour. what's the Tom Hanks and Meryl Streep movie again?
Honestly, my feelings on Three Billboards in Ebbing, Missouri has gone down over time, so I would take that one out. There are some of these that I would not have on here, and there's nothing I can think of that I would put back on just looking at this other than, what was the Florida Project? I would put Florida Project back on. That's the only one I can think of off the top of my head that I would put back into that category, other than some of the blockbustery things that came out last year, like Ragnarok or Wonder Woman. Just because I love Ragnarok so much, but So I don't understand why we need a best, most popular film category when you can kind of. You can manipulate things to make the best picture category that, and it doesn't lose its legitimacy because the winner will always be the movie that the Academy votes for. They're not going to vote for the big blockbustery ones, but they'll be there and they'll be represented, which I'm kind of okay with more than inventing this whole category just to advertise for Disney.
Yeah, exactly.
Every other year.
It's bad. No, and it hurts it hurts movies like Black Panther that kind of deserves because of its craft, because of how good it is overall, because of what it's trying to say, deserve it to be in contention to be nominated for Best Picture, not just to be put on the side for in a second place category for popular films,
right? And it robs a movie like that one, definitely.
And I do wonder how, if that would have really hurt something like Get Out last year, that was super popular, that made hundreds of millions of dollars, and maybe that would have just been put in that popular film category and wouldn't have been in the Best Picture, and that would have been a fucking tragedy.
Yeah, because that movie's still fantastic. Film. I don't know. And there are other things that need to be fixed more than this also. It's not that popular films never make it into the Oscars, it's just that they are just now getting to the point where they're starting to remove members who maybe shouldn't be there anymore, add new members, and they're sort of starting to try and fix that. Whereas there are other things that they should be focusing on, like, you know, giving awards to movies properly, giving awards to comedies and other genres that are not these hard, serious dramas. Because I still think a movie like The Big Sick should have been nominated for more things last year, among others. So this sort of like genre lock that exists within the Academy is something that needs to be more fixed more than giving popular films awards.
I think what they're doing to change the demographic of the people that vote for Oscars is very, is working kind of. We got like The Big Sick nominated for Best Screenplay, and then something like Logan nominated for Best Adapted Screenplay would have never happened like 3 years ago. Like The Dark Knight didn't get nominated for anything except Heath Ledger's performance.
Right. I think it got that and maybe like a couple special effects awards.
Yeah.
Or like a sound award, maybe. Like it was something very small. Small time as far as that movie was concerned, and especially at that time, it was shocking how little attention it got. And it was so weird because that's when they did the 10 movies thing. After that, didn't get any nominations. you know, but, and then the first year that they did that, Inception was there, and it didn't win. Not that, now I don't think it could have won or would have ever won, but at the time I remember being very angry that it didn't win. I think that we are both in agreement that this is not a good thing.
No, and also they're also talking about changing the television format to show to shorten the time. I think lock it at 3 hours with commercial breaks, and maybe show some awards, give out some technical awards during commercials, which sucks.
Here's the thing: if they were making this something where you can see those streaming on the internet, right? Like you could stream the technical awards on YouTube before the actual show proper starts, but it's still part of the same ceremonies and things like that. The opening, though, hasn't happened, and it was something where it's there if you want to look it out and seek it out, but it's not there, you know, on television where most people are seeing it. If that was something that they were doing with this, that I think that would be fine. But the whole thing of just like skipping over it completely, and like you said, doing it during commercials, that just feels like a cheat, kind of.
Because the Oscars is the only ceremony that actually does give out hair awards live on the air in front of like every, like it's the biggest award shows that also gives technical awards on air on their big scene, and like stuff like the Golden Globes, or like if you go into music, the Grammys or the Emmys, they don't do that at all, and that's what makes having the award of an Oscar so prestigious, is that it happens all during that ceremony, and it's all, every Oscar is important. Like when we talked about the Oscars this year, we talked about every one we could, because they're all important, and putting some not on TV makes them less important, makes having an Oscar just a number, kind of like Grammys, where like the biggest artists that release, like Beyonce has like 20-ish Grammys or something like that, and at that point it's not something special. It's just, oh, who has the biggest number of Grammys.
Right. Yeah, and I mean, and with the whole time thing, if you're really that concerned about it, change it from being a live show. That would be my you know, solution to that. Instead of holding the awards and broadcasting them live, where any number of just things could go wrong during the show, and you can't cut them out, you can't cut for time. I think that not doing that will be helpful, if that's really what they're worried about. I think the whole prospect of doing a 5-hour long live show is just something that they need to maybe step away from. That's just me. I don't know.
I wish they'd change the format and do more interesting things. Like, I wish they showed more clips, actually, of the movies themselves.
Yeah. Yeah, that would be great. Instead of like little bits of the trailer that you know they think will sell well, or something to that effect, they really don't. They don't always do a good job of giving you a sense of what some of these movies are. And I feel like sometimes they'll cut to the director seeing them show these clips, and the director's like, "Why are they showing that? Why is that the thing that they're using to represent my movie?" The Oscars, as I've said on the show before, it's an advertisement for these movies. It is what is going to make or break some of these movies in the future, and how they will be seen later on, both economically and just in terms of, you know, how people come back to them. You know, reading through these lists and saying, oh, this movie won in 1998. I wonder if it really deserved to win 1998. And that's sort of the value that these have, sort of keeping a record of what was the thing at that moment that everybody was paying attention to.
Yes.
No, I just, there's a lot there. Yeah. Yeah. I tend to do that. okay.
Maybe last thing maybe we wanted to mention is that what are the positive ways they could, the positive categories they could add that would make the Oscars better? Do you have any ideas?
Well, don't add comedy or musical because we know how that works out. But I do think that there are things that they could do. But I can't really think of any at the moment necessarily.
People talked a lot about adding action choreography and
I do think stunts.
Stunt work.
Something like that. Yeah, I think that would be an interesting thing because, yeah, you can just show action scenes, but you can also do behind the scenes footage.
Yeah.
You could do scenes of stunt choreographers like really showing how these sequences come together, and showing that they are a big part of how these movies are made, and that they really. It's a craft. It is an art form all to itself when it's done well. You know, and they could, I mean, this is a pipe dream, but, you know, in the year that The Raid came out, they could just have the stunt people from The Raid nominated, and they can show you the behind the scenes of them practicing those fight scenes for hours, yeah. Probably.
Just give that award to Mission Impossible this year and show Tom Cruise jumping out of a plane 100 times.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and any number of other movies from other years. John Wick, when that came out, you know, that's a movie that really, like, the stunt work in that movie needs to be celebrated, especially for how low budget that first movie is. Things like that really need to get some attention, I think. That's a good point.
I also like something that the Spirit Award is giving an award to an ensemble cast.
That's one I also think it's a good idea because it gives you a chance to celebrate actors who don't fit into supporting or lead actors.
Yeah, also give awards to a movie that doesn't really have a lead.
Mm-hmm.
Like something like Moonlight had really great performances all around, but none of the three actors were lead enough.
Yeah. Or, I mean, again, Florida Project.
Yeah, Florida Project, of course.
That I wouldn't say that... I'm forgetting his name. But I wouldn't say that Green Goblin is the lead of that movie, but he is a big part of it. It's him and it's those kids and it's the moms or the women playing the mothers and so on and so forth that really make that movie work. But I wouldn't say any of them are the lead or the supporting roles necessarily.
Yeah.
So there's multiple cases where those movies and their casts should be celebrated. Certainly. I would also like do maybe not add another category for this, but maybe focus more on the makeup and costume design people a little bit. 'Cause I feel like people get really excited when they show up, but they always nominate the most just boring movies.
The one thing I read, I think it's Tomri Lahris. I don't remember her name exactly. She's a film critic that talks a lot about costume design, but she talked about splitting the award, the costume award between like contemporary costume and like fantasy or period piece.
That would be interesting.
Because a lot of work goes into something contemporary, but it's never something that's going to win. But it does take a lot of craft.
Yeah, like I mean, a movie like Prometheus, not a perfect movie, but the costume design in that movie still stuns me to this day. Or Blade Runner from last year.
Yeah.
Those movies really, they really grab your attention in terms of the costume design and the set design, and they really don't get nominated or ever win. And I really do think that they deserve it. I guess stuff like that, really. Like, I think that, you know, again, the comedy musical thing, that's a joke because the Golden Globes is just, they're frauds. they're not a real award show, yet they get a television show.
Yeah. Have you ever looked at the people that vote for the Golden Globes? Because there's a bunch of, like... Okay, like there's a couple of Quebec critics that write for like People magazine, like not People magazine, but like paparazzi stuff,
right?
For the Golden Globes. It's completely ridiculous. They're not critics. They're not anything. They just write about who's dating who.
Yeah, it's like 30 people. Also,
it's like 100, I think.
Yeah,
from around it's not the world, but they're not like. It doesn't have to. You don't have to be like a critic or someone with any reputation. I think you just have to pay the right amount at the right moment, and then you got in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it. I mean, it's part of the Harvey Weinstein saga, is that he would schmooze with those guys, and he would buy them drinks, and he would go out partying with them, and he would pay for everything. And it's not even a debate as to whether or not that won him Golden Globe Awards at certain points in time, and that would add steam and add attention to movies that weren't doing well before, and it's debated whether or not he won Oscars because he won Golden Globe Awards by paying for them with booze. I don't understand how the Golden Globe still exists or continues.
Something that is aired on TV that people actually watch, that we watch. Yeah. I watch the Golden Globes. They're bad as awards. I still watch them.
Yeah. I don't know. It's a joke.
It's like being on Twitter. When you start, you're never going to stop.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Like a vampire.
Yeah.
But I do think, though, that adding extra categories based on genre isn't a completely bad idea. You just have to pick the right things, I guess. Like, my separation would be realistic fiction and fiction. That would be how I would separate things, like, you know, actor in a movie that is fiction with a hard F, actor in a movie that is, you know, based on a true story or it's based in reality. Because those are the same practice of the same art, but doing Prometheus versus doing the Swedish girl with a dragon tattoo, those are two different things.
I don't know if I'm with you on that idea of like splitting those movies.
This is the best example I can think off the top of my head. But yeah.
Last thing maybe is that a lot of awards do best first film, and that's I think a very good.
I think that's a brilliant.
A very good.
Like I think because
movies
are bad.
What?
Yeah.
Most first movies are bad, and then you get to honor directors for their work, which aren't like white dudes that did 20 movies before.
Right.
And them having an Oscar is going to finance their 20 next movies. Mm-hmm. Even getting an Oscar nomination.
Yeah, even getting a nomination, like, you basically... You're putting the attention on these people much earlier, much faster, basically. Instead of having to wait till your third or fourth movie to get any attention whatsoever. Some of these directors that are just hitting now, they've been working for 10 years. And if they had a Best First Picture nomination 5 years ago, they would be in a much different position than they are now. That's another good idea. Okay, I think for the most part we've exhausted this topic.
Yes.
Okay, we're half an hour. I think we can just go right into Mission Impossible. Shouldn't be that much of a trek. Mission Impossible 5, guys.
Okay, to take a right turn, yes. Our main topic is we're still doing the Mission Impossible films, and Mission Impossible 5, yes. the 2015 film directed by Christopher McQuarrie.
Yep.
The best until, like, the best so far? Like, not...
Yes.
We'll get into the best of the first five. That's how I'll say it.
I would say so.
Yeah.
I'm still... six is still settling with me.
Yeah.
So, but I would say five is probably the best of these ones where I've had time to really think it over and bake it in my head. And rewatching it, I realized I didn't remember a lot of what happened, but it still worked. It still worked as a movie. And if there's a problem with the Mission Impossible movies, it is that it's like, I don't necessarily remember any of this that just has happened at all. It's probably my favorite one because it combines all the elements of the previous films for me. All the things that I like about the previous movies. That sense of that there is a reality to this world. There's a set of rules in this world and you can't just like write your way out with magic. Which is a common problem in some movies. I'll even dock the Marvel movies for having that problem at times. Not that often, though. They're pretty solid with it. But there is a sense of, like, real, like, espionage stuff in this movie that reminded me a lot of the first, rewatching it and having rewatched number one so quickly afterwards. And I remember at the time being impressed by how grounded number five felt, especially compared to four, even.
Yeah, it is very much a spy movie. Like it's about like spy organizations, one against the other, and it does surprise you multiple times, and it does surprise the characters get played, and it does the perfect mix of action and spy stuff in that opera scene where there's three separate shooters and you don't really know who's with who, what's going on, and Ethan Hunt has no idea what's going on, and that scene is so well edited together, and with the sound and just the timing of everything, it's that mix of like really tense action, because it's a scene with a bunch of shooters and a action fight on top of an opera singer, like in one of the biggest like operas in the world, and at the same time it's just like you are trying to figure out what's going on. Both the characters you root for are trying to figure out what's going on, and it's just plays so well.
Yeah, it's a lot like watching a card game where you don't know the rules of that card game. But the people in that card game are so entertaining with how they play cards.
It's that poker scene in Casino Royale, except everyone has guns.
Right, yes. Yes,
it's guns. An opera.
Yes, guns.
Know what I mean?
Instead of
It combines those two elements really well in a way like movies rarely do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a nice balance of tension and action in this movie in a really great way.
And also a really good tone in general. Like, it does take a bit from the fourth movie. It's like, it's kind of really funny and tongue-in-cheek at times. And I think that also works very well to, like you said, mix all those movies together to make like the perfect Mission Impossible film.
Yeah. Like, there's the fact that Ethan is so aware of how crazy the situation is that's something that it works so well in this movie, and it's the thing that I like the most that is carrying on into 6 and will hopefully carry on into later movies. And it's, as we noticed in our previous episodes, it is there, and it's sort of, like, growing, and it's part of 4, but it really, like, comes to center stage, the sort of, like, okay, I guess I'm gonna fight a 6-foot tall guy. And it's all in his, like, little expression, like, okay, this is the day on the job, I guess. And it's just so well done.
Like this, the plane at the beginning, and when he's,
yes,
where, like, that scene, everyone is like, Ethan doing Ethan again, jumping on a plane. But when he's inside and he's looking at the guards, spots him, and he's like, sorry, man, I'm just doing my job, and just parachutes out with bombs.
That's his face a lot of the time, like, and then he,
sorry, you gotta do what I gotta do.
Yeah, this is, it's the gig. I love that in a lot of this movie. But at the same time, like, there's real stakes to this movie, and every character, even a character who's only going to be on screen for a little bit, they all have a personality to them that feels unique. You know, the girl in the record store, she is an interesting character, even though she's barely there, and I don't even think you've learned her name. But there's something about her that's just interesting to watch. She instantly has chemistry with Tom Cruise, which I think speaks to the strength of the casting in the 5th movie.
Yeah, Rebecca Ferguson is just a perfect add-on to the series. It's really too bad for the actress from 4 that's also really good.
Paula Patton.
Paula Patton, that's really good in 4 and just gets thrown aside like Maggie Q did in the 3rd. And I guess Rebecca Ferguson is the one that just fit.
Yeah. Yeah, that seems to be the case.
She has more than just good on-screen chemistry and being a good, like, being fun to watch. Like, she has an interesting story and, like, subtleties, and she's also a spy getting played and who has her own stakes. And I think also Ilsa Faust is a really, really good name.
Yep, it's a pretty good name. It's a pretty great name.
Even Solomon Lane is just a really good name.
Yeah, that's the other. He's like he's insanely good at naming original characters. Yes. Like their names all, again, they all feel part of the world. Also, like, they don't feel like they're out of left field ever. That stuff is really good, and to the point of, you know, she has her own story. The only person I can think of who doesn't have his own story in this is Luther. He doesn't really have an arc necessarily.
I think Luther doesn't need an arc. He's too cool to have an arc.
Yeah, you know? He's Luther. He doesn't need one.
He's so good in every scene. Like, he steals the show. The camera's on his face, he delivers the perfect line perfectly.
Yeah, but Benji has an arc. Jeremy Renner has an arc, oddly enough, even though he, RIP, I guess, his character. I don't know what happened to him between 5 and 6. I guess we'll find out in 7 at some point. Even he has something interesting. Alec Baldwin has an arc. It's a little bit shoehorned. And the line that, I've listened to a bunch of other podcasts on this because time and things like that. And the line, you are the hands, he's the hands of fate or whatever. Or God's destined man or something like that.
He's destiny.
he is destiny or whatever. It's like, I don't know about that. from the guy who was like, Ethan Hunt is reckless and he shouldn't be doing this job and the IMF needs to be shut down. I don't know if that necessarily makes sense.
It's at a point he's like, we're going to, everyone's on him, sets her watches, then it cuts to 6 months later.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you remember that transition, but I think it's really, really good.
It's pretty good. Yeah, and I forgot that there was kind of a time jump also.
Yeah.
But it really worked for the movie. And again, like, it really introduces Benji's plot, and that he's kind of the POV of a lot of this movie. And a lot of the stakes revolve around Benji in this movie. Him being strapped to a C4 vest. That's all him, really. That's all the relationship between him and Ethan. Which really gets used to great effect in this movie, I think.
Yeah. And also, these action scenes really are really good. Like,
yep.
The underwater scene is just an all-timer for the series. Like, it's so well done. It's so tense. It feels so realistic because it is.
Yeah. Yeah, you can feel, like, when he starts to suffocate, like, you just feel sick. Like, you feel like water, and you're like, I want him to get out of there. I want him to get out now. And he's just slowly suffocating, and it feels so real. And then I forgot that she saved him, actually. But when it happened, it was so exciting and so gratifying.
Yeah.
But I love that it wasn't, like, easy. That's the other thing. It wasn't like, oh, I'll just come in and save the day. Like, it took her some time to actually get out also. Because she's slightly smaller than him, and she's trying to pull a wet, you know, well, in the movie he's probably, like, 6 feet tall. But we know in real life that's not the case. but, yeah, she's trying to pull probably a 200-pound man out of this wet thing or whatever while jets are pulling her back, and she does it, but she does it very realistically. In a movie that is just, it should not be believable. Nothing about it should be,
but that scene is very emblematic of, like, how Christopher McQuarrie does those really good action scenes, in that it gives you, It explains the rule of everything they're going to do, how under the water works, and then goes underwater, and then you're introduced to the bar going around, and that fucks both of them up later. But it's like, you know this, you become familiar with the space where the action takes place, and how the space interacts with the characters, and then what they have to do in that space. And then you know exactly the movements that they should do, but seeing it happen and expecting it to fuck up because it never happens the way you think it's gonna. I think that's the strength of these films. I think we're gonna talk about it later, but McCree is just very good at that sense of space, and even that opera scene. We don't know how the opera is. But we know once you're inside and how everyone is put into position, you start getting more and more of how that space works. And it's always within the boundaries given by the film.
Mm-hmm. And he's also very good at, again, to my whole thing of casting, like, you see the cop who has the, I don't remember what the baton guns or whatever, the baton machine guns, you see him, but you don't know if he's going to be important yet, but you feel it just based off of his presence and how the camera focuses on him and lingers on him. So when he comes back later, you're not surprised that he's back to be the third shooter. So, like, little decisions like that, while, again, like, you're right, that his sense of space, it's up there with someone like Spielberg. In terms of just how good he is at giving you a sense of where you are in relationship to the rest of the scene.
And The last small action scene I really want to mention is the knife fight between Elsa and the bone setter. I think his name is.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it's just the bone doctor.
Yes, yes, the bone doctor.
It's just a really, really good knife fight where they're both getting small cuts and getting like weaker and bleeding a bit, and it's just a very intense fight scene, like the best in the film. Mm-hmm. And I just really, yeah. I just wanted to mention it because for me, it struck me that we rarely see like good knife fight scenes that aren't like. That aren't in a martial arts film where both are really good martial artists. Like,
right.
they're both like good fighters fighting with knives and just like trying to weaken the other as much as possible until you can find a place to strike. And I think it's just a very, very good fight scene.
Yeah, it's a very tense fight scene, and it is very well done. I mean, that whole sequence, though, of them sort of running away and her using Ethan as the shield, like that, it was just so well done. And I love how in sync they are instantly. They have the same thing that Max and Furiosa have in Fury Road. That sense of, like, respect as far as the sense of, I know that you know your craft, and I know that you know what you're doing, and I know that you have skill, and I'm more than willing to rely on your skill when your skill will exceed mine, and vice versa. And that sense of, like, synchronization, and, you know, I will fill in your weaknesses if you will help me fill in mine when need be. And they really have that, and that carries on into Six. I really, really enjoy it.
And I love that he catches Solomon Lane in the same way Solomon Lane caught him at the beginning.
Yeah, that was really good. And even the whole, when he does the CD, or the, not the CD, the vinyl, and, you know, your mission, should you choose to accept it, and how that's flipped on its head. And, you know, we know where you are, Ethan, and now we are coming for you. Like, it's so creepy. Oh, yeah. And I remember it being creepy in the theaters. It's
so good.
Yeah,
the character, and he just kills the girl for no reason other than to fuck up Ethan Hunt.
Yeah, it's really, really good. That sequence is just, everything with Solomon Lane is really good. I think that I forgot how good he is in this role, and he's a shapeshifter, it seems, because I was talking to my brother about this. He forgot that was the same guy until he saw it.
Due to the circumstances, I watched Fallout before 5, before rewatching 5, and I really wish I did the opposite, because it's funny, because I watched when you just see Lane's face in 5 after watching 6, you don't realize it's the same guy until he starts talking.
Yeah, it's his voice that really puts it in synchronization for you. And I forgot how much MI6 was in this movie. I completely forgot about all of that. And I forgot about the Prime Minister thing.
The Prime Minister is just in the film. Like, it's just, oh yeah, we're going to drug the Prime Minister of Great Britain.
Yeah, I thought Nicolas Cage was going to show up for a second. Because, National Treasure. that was very interesting, the way that they used him and how he's like on laughing gas or whatever, truth serum, and he's like, yes, they are going to interrogate you, that's true, and I will hold this gun on this man, yes, absolutely. I thought that was really well handled. I thought the reveal of Ethan being the head of MI6, that was again, like, the mask used properly and not in a terrible way that makes no sense. But again, the mask is so established, it's part of this franchise. So when Ethan does that, it's not even like, oh, I never saw that coming. You're like, oh, well, I kind of expected something like that, but it still works as a reveal also.
Man, I really love Rogue Nation. I kind of want to rewatch it again.
Yeah, I'm as we're talking about it, I'm like, I want to rewatch it again. Like, and there's so many things. Like, it's so good that I forgot how good the motorcycle chase is.
Oh, yeah.
Like, I forgot about it, and I forgot how it ends. I forgot that Elsa just stands out in the road. And I just love that Elsa just... She goes from... She vacillates from being a kind of a bad character, you know, or a character who you're really unsure of her motives throughout the whole movie and whose side she's going to be on. And she's so intimidating when you think that she's on the other side.
Yeah.
That she's just such a good... Yeah, she's such a good part as that. And we'll get to it when we talk more about Six, but I like that Six was able to retain a little bit of that. And I'm interested to see if in Seven she just straight up joins the team and how she will work as just a team member. So, yeah.
I think that's a good place to move on to Six. Which... Yeah. Fucking ruled as well.
It's fucking awesome. Henry Cavill gets struck by lightning. God damn it.
Okay. I just want to talk about names before we begin. Just the names of the characters. Because Henry Cavill's characters is August Walker.
Yeah,
and pretty good. And Angela Bassett's character is Erica Sloan. Which both also very good names. For spy characters.
Yeah, and I can't remember her name, but the sort of the Max character in this movie, again, like bringing back bits from White the previous Widow. Movies. Yeah, White Widow, which also this thing I didn't know is, I guess at one point she does say that her mom's name is
you
Max.
You missed it.
I missed that. Which was like,
what the fuck? She's like, when she's introduced, she's like, oh yes, we're all mourning my mother, Max. And I'm like, what the fuck?
Which is so good. Which makes you think that she's going to be in the later movies, which, like, yes, please. Yeah. Because Max is someone who's like, I would have loved to see her in later movies. She was great. Her and Kittredge, honestly. Like, I would have preferred Kittredge to, what's his face? Anthony Hopkins in 2. Kittredge would have at least been a friendly face. But yeah, that was a moment that was, but that's the thing. She gave me Max vibes enough that I was still very into her character. And she very much feels like a Max 2.0 almost.
It is the movie that ties all those movies together.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I mean, there's so many moments where you're like, this feels a lot like the first one. And the fact that Ethan is sort of being framed again. And it's really, you know, taking into account the fact that four out of the five movies, he has been disavowed at some point or another.
And they used that against him. That's the part that's that's really good. Is that how many times can he be disavowed and come back and be the good guy? They use that in the time in the trailer, but also it's like, oh yeah, how to use his history of being like having a perfect record of coming back and doing the right thing against him.
Yeah, like I mean, I imagine in Seven they'll be like, I mean, the person who taught him, he betrayed us. Why shouldn't Ethan why shouldn't he go down the same road? Well, because the new Ethan will hunt him down probably. but yeah, like it's a very good acknowledgement of everything that came before this movie. I think that's the thing that Macquarie has brought to these movies, is that acknowledgement of this is sort of the soup that I have to draw from, and I have to take pieces from these previous movies. And I think it's very much a choice to say I'm gonna make this into something that feels cohesive with the other movies, which is incredibly difficult because, as we mentioned, the first three movies feel very different from one another, and four less so, but still, it has its own speed to it. So making these movies feel cohesive after the fact is impressive, and both of these movies just do that in an interesting way.
Did the ending work for you? Did the, like, did their reunion, the scene with Michelle Monaghan with Julia.
I liked that.
Because we were talking, I was talking with a friend of ours, Tayo, that for him it didn't work at all. And I think it's the fact that we rewatched all those movies and like saw that relationship when it worked, and the ending of 4 when they have a glimpse of each other and are both just happy, and seeing the character of Ethan and what he's becoming. And I don't know, for me it was, for me that could have been the ending of the Mission Impossible films and I would have been happy, you know?
It's
both these characters being happy with what the other is doing and just giving their, like, she's in danger because she was his wife, but she's just alleging that she feels safer because he exists and he's there and he's protecting everyone. I love that. I love that ending.
Yeah, I think it was a very, I think it's a very way, good way of using her without sort of setting her up to be the romantic interest again or bringing her back and, you know, really going into, you know, what it means to be a spy and have a wife, which is something that they kind of dodged in probably the best way that they could. But yeah, like, I think that that was an interesting way to sort of almost finish that storyline off. We don't necessarily need to see her again.
I don't think we'll see her again, and I think that's for the best. It's the perfect emotional ending to that story.
Yeah. Yeah. And it gives gives Tom and Elsa some more room, you know what I mean? But no. but that's another thing. They really, that's something I do like also, that it doesn't open this movie with, well, Ethan and Elsa have been dating for these last few years. That's not where things are. They're professionals, and they went off on their own professional lives, and they're just seeing each other now after all this time, and their friendship is sort of, you know, being pushed in an interesting way. And I like how they utilize her as a sort of semi-antagonist, and the way that she plays that. But she plays it, it's even more interesting because they do feel like there's so much more history between them. And maybe they have gone on other missions in between or something to that effect. You know, maybe they have been interacting in between movies, and that you feel it in their performances, even if it's not confirmed on screen.
Yeah. You know, they have that just chemistry that really works. And she has that chemistry as well with the other parts of the team, which I think is just, she's the perfect addition to that, like the perfect force member with Benji and Ving Rhames.
Like, and again, there are so many things that they really hit hard on, you know, the whole Ethan doesn't kill thing. They make that an interesting piece of this movie with, you know, I love the way that the hospital sort of fake out happens, and I love Benji as Wolf Blitzer, which was really, really good. And the way that, I just like that. I love the deception, the sense of, you know, that these are people who are professional liars. And that's something, again, that isn't necessarily in all the previous movies, but it's really a big part of this one. And it feel, again, that's something that feels like something you'd see in the first movie also.
Yeah. The one thing that really bothered me watching this was, like, that's a really personal experience, is that I got there 4 minutes late because I was in Lebanon and couldn't, like, get into the screening. And anyway, I missed the first 4 minutes, and I went online just to watch them after the fact. And that dream at the beginning is very weird.
Yeah.
Like, it serves nothing.
It's weird. There are little touches in here,
like, they're just to remind you that Julia exists, maybe if you haven't seen those previous films or don't remember them.
Yeah, maybe you're supposed to assume that, I mean, we all know Ethan has superpowers, clearly. so he has more superpowers?
Yeah. Like, he knows in the bottom of him how that she's going to see him again. That yeah. they're going to see each other again. And
yeah.
anyway, I think this is credit to this movie that I missed that and I missed the whole mission briefing and I just got it. You know, the movie is very good at just like showing without needing to tell you what's going on and or just mm-hmm. integrating it between the conversations with the character. So
yeah.
like, I feel like it's the kind of movie if I wasn't a Mission Impossible fan and it was just playing on TV, I could put it on, get exactly what's going on and have a great time watching it, you know? Just start from the yeah. middle. You always know what the characters have to do and just there's the pleasure of watching him do it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Do you want to talk about the action scenes? Because maybe 5 is better overall. I need to rewatch this. I think we both do, and we'll probably have a conclusion at the end of the year when it's on both our lists, maybe.
I think it's going to be on my list.
I think
me too.
I think there's no... I haven't seen anything this year that's... Like, maybe a couple of, like, indie dramas, you know? But nothing... Yeah. No blockbusters that was
on this level. This is... It's interesting, because this year for Blockbuster, it's been very... That was okay. That was good, you know? I haven't really been disappointed that much this year, but it's been kind of...
Like,
been
other than Black Panther, I don't think there's anything I even consider as, like, great.
Yeah, I'd have to go back through my list of movies.
I think you like Infinity War more than me, but yeah, that's...
But even that was as a Marvel fan. Like,
yeah, understandable.
That was on the Marvel scale, I guess. Of like, and also, I think my opinion might completely change after part 2. So even if I did put it on my top 10, I would have that little asterisk of like, this might completely be different in a year. There's not really that much of this year that really stands out to me. You know, like Annihilation. Pick my top 10 right now. Because that movie I think about it every day. I think about the bear every day.
Yeah, that's...
that fucking bear.
Yeah.
Help me. I think Mission Impossible is going to stick with me also. Like, because, like, there are moments in this movie that are really just, like, great. And I love them. But some of them... I love them almost because I shouldn't love them. I don't know how to say it. Like I love that. I mean, spoilers for this movie. Henry Cavill dies in the most grotesque way of anybody in all movies since fucking what's his face in the first movie. Like, he gets it bad. He gets a fucking hook through the fucking head, and then he blows up. It's really the gruesome death of the main villain. That was really good. All the action sequences, though, I think they're really well done. But I think the moments of tension are some of the best. The two bombs.
Yeah.
And the way that those are utilized.
The two bombs and the detonator. And that shot at the end that's like just to make you wonder for a second... Did they fuck up? You know what I'm talking about? When you see him almost at the detonator and the white light in the background.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and him rock climbing, which, oh my god. Oh my god. Yeah. That was so... He has rock climbing skills from the second movie. Christopher McQuarrie is a genius. But no, like, that's, again, like, that goes to the thing, like, there's a synthesis of these previous movies, and he knows what parts to pick. Him being able to free climb is cool on its own, taken out of the second movie, and the fact that that's still there is yeah, it adds something to it. And it adds something to the fact of, like, you know he has that ability, so you feel like the stakes aren't that high of him getting away from Cavill on that cliff and getting to that thing. But there's still the tension of, like, yeah, but there's, like, 10 seconds left or something like that.
And you know he's gonna get it. Like, you know.
Right, you know.
They're not gonna kill everyone. But still, mm-hmm. you do... You're like, oh, shit, did they do it? Oh, mm-hmm. thank God they didn't.
Yeah. That would be interesting if they did.
Yeah.
And that's the thing. They get you a number of times with that. I mean, until I remembered the whole fake mask thing and that it could just all be a setup, I was like, did they really blow up Germany off screen? Is that something that they just did in this movie?
Yeah, no,
that's a big deal.
So... Because they did blow up the Kremlin in the first movie. Like,
right.
It's possible in this yeah. universe that something like this happened. And then, like, I think a minute in that scene, I'm like, oh, yeah, they fucked him up.
Yeah. Yeah, but, yeah, that was... Yeah, it's just a really smartly made movie, I think. And again, like, I love that after you realize that it has been a success, like, I just love the way that he spits the key out. I don't know why, but, like, his facial expression is like, pugh! Like, he's just so disgusted by it. But it's so victorious also. And I love his, like, relaxed face of, like, but he's still so exasperated by the whole situation that he has to be there.
I have to do this again and again. That's what I am.
Yep. This is my life now, I guess. There's just so many moments like that, you know, like, and I do like that they used the shot of him breaking his leg, even though it's barely there.
Yeah.
I
didn't pay attention. I need to rewatch it and just look for that scene.
Yeah, it's interesting, to say the least.
And this movie is so, like, every scene is really, really good. Like, there's nothing that made me stop and rethink what I was watching. Like, let's talk about the bathroom scene, because we talked about Mercury and sense of space, and that's one scene that does it perfectly. Like, you're slowly introduced to, okay, there's a mirror, there's the walls are like this, the stars are there, the urinals are there, like, with a slow shot of them walking around and seeing who's there, and then the douchey
European guy.
Yeah. Like a French guy is making fun of them because they think they're having sex in the toilet.
Yeah, who got no subtitles. So actually, I've been waiting to ask you this. What-ish were they saying, I guess? Like, because I didn't catch it.
Oh, no, they were saying, like, you guys are having fun. What does it take to have
it's
over? Like, maybe a bit of homophobia, just like a tiny bit, but it felt more like friendly than anything else. It's like, oh yeah, it's like, oh, there's a couple in the stall, let's make fun of them. You know?
That's great. Oh, wait, no, okay, so I do think there were subtitles for that, but, like, I guess before, when they first walked in, what were they saying? They were laughing about something. I was just curious what they were saying.
I don't remember, nothing. Okay. Just, like... Like, they were talking about the party, I think. Nothing very...
Ah, okay.
Damn it,
Recor. I thought you were setting up another movie or something. That would be an interesting choice. Okay.
That bathroom fight is... Like...
It's pretty great.
John Lark beating the fuck out of both of them?
It's really good.
Is it so unexpected from that trailer? Like... I thought they were going to fight each other in that bathroom. I think we all did. And then they're fighting both together fighting another guy that's beating the fuck out of them. Even even August Walker and his huge arms, his reloading arms.
But there are moments they seem to be unaffected. Yes, they seem to be. But it's just, yeah, that whole sequence is, it's really good, and I love the difference between, again, it goes to the difference between this August character and Ethan, where it's, August is just trying to kill. He's just this, you know, Angela Bassett says it, you know, he's a hammer, and Ethan is a scalpel, and he's trying to keep this guy alive so he can use his face later on. So yeah, like I love the way that fight works and how it utilizes the character and what it tells you about these characters and who they are. And that's something that, again, McQuarrie and whoever does the stunts for these movies, they do a really good job of that and making everybody feel unique in how they do combat. Even Rebecca Ferguson, like, she's just, there's something different about the way that she fights, which feels very unique to her. Much in the same way that Charlize Theron fought in Atomic Blonde last year. There's that same sense of, like, she's a woman, so she has to fight a little bit differently, but she's still just as effective at her best as the guys in a given situation.
Yeah, no. And sorry, I'm just thinking about the action scenes in the film, and they're just all good.
Mm-hmm.
The chase scene in Paris.
Well, the two chase scenes.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah, they're both.
They're just really, really good chase scenes in Paris. They don't have to do. They're not like. There's no gimmicks.
Mm-hmm. And I love in this one, they do the thing of setting up the plan, but it's not his plan. And it's him changing the plan.
Yeah.
So you don't actually know what his change is, and even his change goes wrong. Which is just great. I love how that is utilized. And I love that August is there to sort of question their methods the whole time. Of like, really? This is what we're doing? This is how we're going to do this? This is really what IMF does on a daily basis. Okay. And I just love that sort of chaotic sense of somebody who just disrupts the whole thing.
Yeah. And then when they do make it out, they're about to get in the car to open the garage, and then there's the French cop.
Mm-hmm.
And that scene is like very, very tense and very powerful of Eden trying to really do the right thing and be the, like, man, it's just in the middle of two like very action scenes. You have that slow, very tense scene, very emotional, and you just want her to leave, like,
Yeah, there's a lot of tension in that
scene. Yeah.
And I love the way that they cut to John Lark and him reaching for his gun, and you buy it because he's CIA, and CIA, they're not the most reputable group in terms of keeping people alive. It's just, there's a sense of danger whenever he's on screen that I think really works for the movie and adds to it.
I think that's one of those moments that just really makes this film for me, like, more than the action that's perfect, like some of the best like realistic action scenes you'll ever see. But it does have like those small, really emotional moments that really work. Like when the plan is first described to Ethan, and it's like, and then we kill all the cops, and just seeing how he reacts to that, he's like, oh yeah, of course, like he can't even lie, like. He can't even lie, like, he's used to lying. He's just yeah. like, oh yeah, I killed thousands of people. Yeah,
right. Then, why would I? Why would I not be okay with this?
Yeah, like, exactly.
Yeah, it's yeah, yeah. Like, really, they really do an interesting job of testing the limits of how far Ethan is willing to go, and making that a prime theme of this movie, I guess.
Yeah, making it cementing that his character is the one that's not willing to sacrifice one person if they have the choice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it, I mean, there's a lot of things that come out of it that are very interesting, and like, I think Chris McQuarrie, he understands, I guess, heroism in a way that a lot, and sort of that sort of do-gooder, you know, there's only one right way thing, and he nails that, I think.
Yeah.
And Ethan is that sort of, you know, Boy Scout type character in a weird way, or in an interesting way. And he really utilizes that through Tom. And Tom, he just nails that type of thing.
Agreed. Is there anything else you want to mention? I like the Benji and Ilsa versus Solomon Lane fight at the end. Like, another fight with a very good sense of space. Mm-hmm. And, like, using the environment to just, like, to the detriment and advantage of both groups fighting, of Solomon and of Ilsa and Benji.
Yeah, and that fight has more meaning after rewatching 5.
Yeah.
Because I forgot about the whole Benji plot, but it really works. There's something personal in it for Benji and for Ilsa, so it only makes sense that they would be the ones who fight him at the end.
Exactly.
That sequence really works. And again, tension is something that McQuarrie works really well in, and it's something, you know, I would almost suggest next he should do something very Hitchcock like that would be something that I think would be right up his alley, something smaller, something very thriller-ish. That would be interesting from him.
I like, he can do anything, and I mean, like, he did two of the best action films of the last few years, and I want to see him do more whatever.
Yeah. I'm in. Whatever it might be, I am totally in.
And last thing I want to say, we talked a bit about Julia in the end, and I love that the Julia we get is the Julia we have at the end of 3, the one that after Eden is heart stopped, she's the one who took the gun and killed those two guys and saved him.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's that Julia that traveling the world and saving people in the darkest places in the world, and then when there's a nuclear bomb, she's like, what can I do to help immediately?
Yeah. I love that part of her character, that she is somebody who is she's adaptable to whatever the moment is. She really works.
And for me, that's why that conclusion works so well, is that they both can, like, she's the one that can say that they both make each other be the best they can be. And she would have never been that without Ethan. And that she wants both of them to continue to be the best at what they do. And I think that's just a great conclusion, continuing the end of 3, the end of 4, and now back to that. Man, this, I really need to rewatch 6, because I think I like 6 more than 5. I think 6 is just an amazing film. Just talking about it, they're both really great, but I think me liking that chase scene on the top of the rooftops, and then Henry Cavill just escaping, and he's like, yeah, if you follow me, we're just gonna kill everyone. I'm just gonna kill Julia.
Yeah, like it was. Yeah, it's. Yeah, all the chase stuff is really good, and even like the reveal of Henry Cavill is really good.
Yeah.
And like.
Okay. Yeah. The only thing that isn't good is that fucking scene where Alec Baldwin dies.
Yeah, because the director dies so often, and we. I want some stability, goddammit.
Alec Baldwin never feels like a character in this film particularly. I think he just feels mm-hmm. like Alec Baldwin. And Alec yeah. Baldwin tries to be a hero and dies. It just does nothing for me.
Yeah, it does. It does. It doesn't really work. And also, like, I don't know, like, I'd almost be like, hey, again, bring Kittredge back in the first...
Yeah.
bring back Henry Cerny. Let's see what happens. That would be interesting. But actually, yeah. I wouldn't be surprised if they did that. Yeah. So. But, yeah.
I don't know. If they have Angela Bassett as the director that,
yeah.
that doesn't yeah, really like kind of... Ethan, I think that's kind of a... Kind of doesn't really like, but respects him and his role.
Yeah, that's there's kind of an M.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's kind of like a 90s and Casino Royale M thing going on there. Yeah. It is interesting.
Yeah, so. No, I feel that's the... It does set up for that, and I think, yeah, if in the next movie we get to see Anja Bissett with a gun just go strange days on people.
Oh, yeah. That, oh, you just brought that movie back for me. Yes, yes. Have her driving a limo.
Yeah.
Yes, I'm into it.
And shooting... people in the face, and
Ray Fiennes should have a cameo. well, not Juliette Lewis, but if you can get her, sure. But okay, wait, she's a Scientologist, isn't she? So they can definitely get her, actually. Like, they 100% get her. but yeah, no, that would be really what we're asking for is a Strange Days reunion. Hell, see if you can resurrect what's his face who died recently. But yeah, no, that's an interesting point that I completely forgot about her in that movie. But yeah, her shooting people in the face, I want to see that again because she's
Like Anja Bissett can be a very good action star,
mm-hmm.
and yeah. I think. She could be that. Like, she could do what Alec Baldwin did, but way better.
Yeah. I'm interested. And if they kill her off in 8, I'm fine with it, I guess.
Yeah, exactly.
As long as she has a prominent role in 7. Yeah, I'm curious to see where they go. I guess that's something to talk about it for a little bit. Where do you think they go? Because
space.
Yes. Yes. Well, I mean, here's the thing. Them convincing Elon to let Tom ride outside one of his rockets isn't that far-fetched.
Yeah.
Like,
true. Very true.
Yeah.
Or maybe go super small.
Yeah, I think that would be the other way. Like, I mean...
Like have... Like, a part of that... A big part of that movie just be set, like, the first one in a single heist.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
like,
yeah.
Bring, yeah. Like, 6 is huge and very well... I don't know. Mm-hmm. I have no idea.
I do think there's something interesting there, though, of going small. Going small is an interesting idea, and that they've gotten so big that I think the most interesting place is to go small. There's something to be said for the fact that Ant-Man and Ant-Man and the Wasp are both very interesting movies because they both came out after massive Avengers movies. And there's something interesting there, I guess. If you're watching a franchise. So I think like a small like IMF movie, like just one mission and you're just on that mission almost in real time. And you're just hoping that the team gets out alive. That would be an interesting thing to sort of going to. Yeah. Okay. But yeah, that's interesting. The other thing for Seven, I guess, would be, I assume the syndicate isn't over. So maybe finish that out. I don't know who they get to replace McCrory, because apparently he doesn't want to come back. Because Six was so good, he's like, I'm out.
I'll be back if I ever have like great ideas.
Mm-hmm. But like, I'm gonna go out on top, which is actually, I really respect that. Actually, yeah. Like, you know, go out when you're on a high note. Don't ruin.
Anyone you want to do the next one?
There are names that I could think of. A lot of them won't happen. Like, I think Matthew Vaughn, if he was willing to actually listen to a studio and take studio notes, he would actually make a very interesting Mission Impossible movie. It'll be pretty. You can guarantee that. Like, it'll be stylish as hell. But I don't think he could actually do it. I would go for a writer... Yeah.
It's like the obvious pick, I think. Like,
yeah.
Yeah, who can direct great action films?
Yeah. Like, my pick would be someone who has been in the action world a lot, like Chris McQuarrie has been. Like, he's been around action movies and he's worked on action movies, and he has an understanding of what makes a good action movie, but he hasn't necessarily made one yet. So that would be my pick. Sort of a veteran who hasn't had a chance to show off their abilities yet. Or one of the John Wick guys. You know? But, and have Chris McQuarrie come back to do like a script write-up or something.
I just said Karen Kusama.
Oh, that would be a good one. Yeah. Yeah, she could. I think she could do it, definitely.
I just wanted to direct more things.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, I just don't want her to do things that she doesn't feel like she can do, I guess. Yeah. Like, that's why Ian Flux happened. which I don't blame on her, but I feel like that was someone asking her to do a movie that maybe wasn't what she wanted to do. I do want her to work more. Yeah. Interesting. All right, I think we're good on Mission Impossible for now. We'll do another podcast when Seven comes out, whenever that happens, probably. Yes.
I think it's up there. It is definitely up there as like the best franchise.
Yeah.
In quality, like other than except two are good or great. Or incredible.
Because here's the thing, with the exception of two, I would watch any of these movies any day of the week, like when they're on TV or whatever. Just like, they're great background movies. But I think 5 and 6 are definitely on another level for me.
Yeah, I think it's the best movie franchise.
Yeah, I'm trying to think of one that I like more. It's like, I don't like Star Wars more. I don't like
because there are bad Star Wars films, like multiple bad Star Wars.
Right. Yeah, they're like awful Star Wars film. And this one really, it's just one.
Yeah,
it's just one really. Like, yeah. Whereas like. One of my favorite franchises, James Bond, there are 7 stinkers that I will never watch again, and I would never wish on anyone. But this is like, there's one bad one, and then a bunch of movies that are like, they're all easily just very enjoyable and very watchable. And god dang it, Tom Cruise is just so charming. Can he just stop? I would not suggest Paramount stop making these, because this is what we need more of. not giant robots who are racist. please.
Also, the movie already made almost $500 million on its, yes, like, $180 budget. And I think that's the proof that just make a quality action film and it's going to make a bunch of money. Like, it's great. Just make more movies like this. Just give McCreary whatever the fuck he wants to do.
Yeah. Give him something. And fans, if any of you give him shit, I will hunt you all down. You are the reason we won't get a Chris McCreary Superman movie, and I hate all of you for it. All of you. So, yeah. But, I'm very curious to see where they go from here. All right, let's go to Plux, I guess, because we're just spinning our wheels a little bit.
Yeah. Just follow me on Twitter at Easter, and text your mom, hi. How are you doing?
That's actually pretty good advice. tell her you love her, and all that stuff. Phantom Zone podcast, every single week, multiple times a week sometimes. Taking a short break because I was in another city for a while. But a new episode actually going to come out like right after we're recording this, so go listen to that. Project Hawkeye, name to be revealed soon, actual thing of what that is coming soon, so pay attention to that. And I think that's all I have for plugs, other than AA Haro on all the social medias. Bye.
Bye.
Fuck, we're all Emmerich.